So this is the new year, and I don't feel any different. Yes, folks, we are officially kicking off 2024 with some classic Death Cab for Cutie lyrics. Hello, and happy new year. Welcome to the very first 2024 edition of the Reason Roundtable. I am Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, who is busy eating frogs. Today, I'm joined by Roundtable regular Catherine Mengu Ward, as well as special guests Elizabeth Nolan Brown and Zach Weissmuller. Everyone say hello.
Howdy, New Year.
Hi, Happy New Year.
Hi.
Happy Tuesday. So I've already said Happy New Year, but it does seem like some people are not, in fact, feeling very happy about the passage of time. For example, here are just a couple of the headlines that ran on our very own Reason.com recently. The Year of Bad Vibes by Liz Wolfe, in which Liz wrote about how in 2023, statists had their way with us all, making many things a little less fun and free in the process. And then there was Matt Welch, who, before exiting stage left, gave us this hopeful, uplifting headline. Prediction, 2024 will see deadly political violence in the streets. Credit to Matt Welch, he does not bury the lead. Welch's post was largely about the current highly charged political environment and the particular way that election years make people extra special crazy. His post included the following burst of rhetorical sunshine from the man who is currently the leading contender for the GOP presidential nomination, Donald Trump. I'm going to try and read this all in one breath. Merry Christmas to all, including crooked Joe Biden's only hope, deranged Jack Smith, the out-of-control lunatic who just hired outside attorneys fresh from the swamp, unprecedented to help him with his poorly executed witch hunt against Trump and MAGA, included also our world leaders, both good and bad, but none of which are as evil and sick as the thugs we have inside our country, who with their open borders, inflation, Afghanistan surrender, green new scam, high taxes, no energy independence, woke military, Russia, Ukraine, Israel, Iran, all electric car lunacy, and so much more. There's more somehow, are looking to destroy our once great USA. May they rot in hell. Again, Merry Christmas.
I think that was like eight breaths.
Yes, that was more breaths than I intended. But I think you guys get the idea there. Merry Christmas, right? That's Happy New Year. So I wanna take that and then just check the mood here. I want to go around the panel and see what is your personal sense of the coming year on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being global Armageddon and 10 being total anarcho-libertopia, where large dogs live forever. We are going to keep this pretty simple and call this segment Happy News Year. Catherine, let's start with you.
Listen, politics is going to be bad this year. I was doing some, year-end reflecting, I don't really do like resolutions for myself exactly, but like pondering the year to come. And I just decided like this is the year that I'm going to take Chris Fryman's advice and remember, as he wrote in Reason Magazine a while back, that it is okay to ignore politics. I recognize that will be in tension with my full-time job, but that you can like emotionally.
I'm going to remind you of that when I don't know what's going on in the news someday.
Yeah.
And you're like, Peter, why aren't you writing about the news?
Like there are parts of policies that will be interesting and important. I plan to engage with those. But I do think this year you are right that and Matt is right and Liz is right. It's the vibes are going to be bad, but I don't necessarily actually think the policy will be that bad this year. Joe Biden will continue Joe Bidening. It's going to be not good Joe Bidening type policy. I anticipate it that it will basically roughly match the bad policy of the last 3 years, which was, I think, like it's a muddle through. It's a five-ish. That's where we are.
I think there will be less terrible new spending this year just because Congress isn't going to do anything. Zach, how about you? Catherine, before we go to Zach, 1 to 10, global Armageddon or large
five-ish.
Dogs live forever?
I'm going with five-ish, I think every year is a five-ish.
All right, every year is a
five. I want to give you like a, we're just here muddling through, we're doing our best. It is what it is.
Zach?
I'm going to rank it a solid 4. I think we've been slowly escaping the high 2 to mid 3 range that we hit during the depths of the COVID pandemic and kind of
dark,
crawling our way towards a 5. But given the insane election year that we're all guaranteed, I'm going to deduct a point and put us at a 4.
Liz?
5. Just like Catherine said, I think most years are fives. You know, we things pretty much just, I'm of the like things pretty much just stay the same camp. I also agree with Catherine that like the vibes are going to be really bad because of the election. But also, I mean, that's going to actually maybe give us less terrible policy than we would have in a normal year, because, you know, people are so consumed with that they're not as consumed with like making up terrible things to do in Congress and in state houses. So, you know, those two things cancel each other out, and we come to a five.
All right, so we have two fives and a four. Our average here is something like a 4.75. And I was when we started today, I was going to give this a five. And you know what? I'm not. I'm changing my
answer.
This
is like when you go to the restaurant and everyone orders the same thing and then you have to change your order. You don't have to change your order. If it's a five, it's a five.
I am changing my order because you cannot have everyone order Negronis. Somebody has to order a daiquiri here.
Mezcal
and, you know,
Negroni.
And right. You can't have everybody do the same thing, right? So I do think the threat of serious political chaos is very real this year, and it worries me. But I also think we are on the cusp of some pretty exciting stuff that will make the world much better. And that once we get past the current political quagmire, the next wave of political discourse is going to be much more interesting and more invigorating. So I'm going to give this year a seven. That's my vibe.
Wow.
And we're gonna muddle through, but it's gonna be okay. So I want to now move on to something a little more specific beyond the vibes. Let's do some predictions. What concretely do you expect to happen in 2024? So I want everyone to make one 2024 prediction about politics or governance or policy, and then one about culture, tech, everything else, just something in the non-politics realm. Catherine, again, let's start with you.
I am feeling optimistic about the year for marijuana policy. And that is despite the strong thread of I can smell the marijuanas in the streets, which tells me it is global Armageddon, like think piece genre that is existing in the world right now. A new poll came out just recently showing that we are now at 70% of the public that thinks that marijuana should be legal. And that's true in like every group is basically in favor. So 91% of self-identified liberals support legal marijuana, but 52% of self-identified conservatives do also. So we are over the tipping point, even for people who identify themselves as conservatives to pollsters. The olds also 64% in favor. I just think that we're going to keep seeing progress. Right before the end of the year, Biden expanded the list of crimes that were subject to some federal pardons. So this is just a very narrow subset of people who were on, you know, federal lands or in Washington, D.C. when they committed mostly possession or intent to possess type crimes. But still, that's progress. So I am optimistic about the marijuana policy, even though there is a kind of chattering class backlash occurring.
Zach, what do you predict in the realm of politics and in the realm of culture and technology and everything else?
Mm-hmm. On the political side, I am expecting to see another major speech suppression push online, similar to the kind of suppression, blacklisting, manipulation of discourse that we saw during COVID. I think that's going to happen again in the run-up to the election. And I think it's going to look a lot different this time because, A, with Elon Musk running X and taking a different approach to content moderation, I think the contrast with how that platform handles things is going to be a lot different than the other platforms. The difference is likely to be rather striking, and that's good. We want a marketplace of platforms. And then there's also the looming Missouri v. Biden case at the Supreme Court, which in the past I've interviewed one of the plaintiffs, Jay Bhattacharya, about that. And that's going to help settle the question or at least give some more clarity on how far can the government go in terms of communicating and leaning on the tech companies, jawboning them into compliance to remove the kind of controversial but completely legal speech that we saw happen throughout the pandemic. So that could very seriously rein in what I see as a disturbing and inappropriate level of meddling, but if there's one thing government bureaucracies are good at, it's self-preservation and figuring out loopholes to keep perpetuating their themselves and their agendas. So I do predict we'll see the speech police strike back with a vengeance this year. So that's the political side of things. The cultural and technological side of things, I predict that this is going to be the year Bitcoin goes mainstream. And this is not investment advice, and I'm not sure why anyone would take a journalist investment advice anyway, but more so, I'm just noting that the regulators are potentially going to approve a Bitcoin ETF as early as next week. And if that happens...
Can you explain what that is in like two sentences?
Sure. An exchange-traded fund. So it'll essentially allow big institutions like Vanguard and BlackRock and Fidelity to hold Bitcoin, something that reflects the value of Bitcoin. And so all the people who have their money and, you know, 401ks and IRAs there will be able to allocate some of their money into Bitcoin easily without having to have the technical know-how to actually self-custody their own Bitcoin.
And, so in some ways, Bitcoin is going to be more integrated into the traditional stock market.
Precisely. And like the most interesting aspect of that to me isn't just, you know, number go up, but more so that it'll offer Bitcoin significant political protection with these large stakeholders now involved with it. And that's going to be helpful because we have politicians like Elizabeth Warren in the Senate gunning for crypto broadly, but I think also Bitcoin in particular, since it's the big boy, it's the OG. And it's also just going to be an interesting turning point because if you're someone who's never paid much attention to it, but now some percentage of your retirement or savings goes into it, then maybe that sparks some curiosity. And when you start to get curious and learn more about Bitcoin, you then start to learn more about the ideas of people like Mises and Hayek. And Bitcoin's created a lot of libertarians. So I'm hopeful that we'll see that trend accelerate in 2023.
Are you worried at all that this might also kind of like immunize the eschaton? Like when everything does go to hell, which it will, people will be mm-hmm. like, you know what the real problem was? Those Bitcoin ETFs. Like, you know, I sort of share your optimism generally, but I have this concern that
somehow or another, we're going to have a debt crisis caused by far too much federal spending. And then Elizabeth Warren will be like, it's because of Bitcoin.
Right. Well, I think this is kind of like the marijuana stuff. It's like a whole bunch of stuff is kind of like wrong on the streets of our cities that clearly has to do with some like very major macro trends. But people are like, smells like weed. Must be that. Like, are you worried, yes. Zach? What I'm saying, I guess, is I'm worried.
Yes,
should
it
I
does
worried?
Worry me that there's going to be, you know, graphs of like some economic downturn with the line that shows Bitcoin ETF approved and it has, you know, nothing to do with it. And also the other worrying thing that I've heard expressed in the Bitcoin community is that once it gets integrated into the mainstream financial system, that there's going to be lobbying to only allow people to hold it through an ETF, and they're going to go after self-custody and exchanges and so forth. So there are definitely ancillary concerns like that. Bitcoin at this point is fairly resilient, and people are good at holding it in ways that are difficult for the government to stop. So I think it's proven itself fairly resilient. But yeah, those are always legitimate concerns to hold in mind.
I'm just excited for the eventual Warren coin. Liz, what are your two predictions?
In the policy realm, that we're going to see just, it's going to be the year of bad age verification laws. The laws saying that you have to be 13 or 16 or 18 in order to get on various social media sites or to, you know, use the internet more broadly in some cases of these legislation. We've already seen a couple of states pass them. There's like a billion other states that are considering them at the moment. I don't think that they'll go anywhere at the federal level, hopefully, but maybe that's overly optimistic. I definitely think we'll see more states passing them. And you know, part of the way you can tell this is heating up, in addition to the fact that, you know, politicians just keep introducing these laws, is that Facebook, like my, when I watch Hulu, it is nonstop Meta ads that are asking for this regulation. It reminds me of that like parody Gadsden flag, where it's got like the snake with the ball gag in his mouth and someone stepping on him and he's like, oh, please step on me. Like that's basically what these ads are. Facebook's just like, we think that you should regulate us and make us not, because, you know, obviously Facebook has the capacity to deal with, they did the same thing with Section 230. They have this capacity to deal with age verification laws or Section 230 being obliterated or whatever else it is. I mean, it'll be a burden for them. But
they also have an influence operation in Washington that just means that because they are the biggest player, politicians are going to take their concerns, even if they're not writing the legislation literally themselves or the regulations literally right. themselves. Politicians are going to take their concerns more seriously and think more about them than any other sort of upstart player that is not high on the minds of the folks who are writing these laws and these rules. And that gives them an advantage in that they can shape the regulation, even if they're not, you know, literally the ones in the rooms writing it. That means they can shape the regulation in ways that are going to be advantageous to their business model.
Right, exactly. So they want it, and it's going to be a big pain for much smaller tech companies. And also, as you know, we repeat a reason again and again, it's going to be just like absolutely privacy killing if this stuff does pass, which is like the secret reason that everyone wants it. It's not that, you know, I mean, I don't think most politicians are that concerned that your 16-year-old or 18-year-old is, you know, looking at Instagram photos, but people want to be able to attach real identities to everyone on the internet, which is what happens with these laws. So that's why they are so popular, and we're just unfortunately going to have to be dealing with that. Seeing a lot of court cases too, hopefully smacking them down as tends to happen with these things, but not before, you know, more and more places try them. In the cultural realm, I'm going to go with that we're going to just see a lot more freakouts about sex and fertility and family size, you know, all three of those things together. As we do, this sometimes leads to like bad policy, but more it's just general like, you know, just general freakouts. Like you have the conservatives running more. You know, we're gonna see more conservative magazines running articles that are like, teenagers need to get knocked up in the backs of cars because babies, which was actually like a real National Review article last month. We're gonna see more people on the left being like, it's because like the women are doing too much emotional labor and you know all this stuff. And so I just think, you know, we're gonna see just it's both sides converging on these narratives, even though the left is like, it's capitalism's fault, and conservatives are like, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know where they're going with the teen sex thing. But
so the liberals are gonna end up calling for an emotional labor union, while the conservatives are just going to be like, kids need to get back into cars.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
Driverless cars could be a boon for getting teenagers knocked up in the back of cars, though. If you think about that, like
self-driving cars.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't even have to have like a makeout point or whatever
right.
in your town.
And, you know, you can take the car out.
The robot car.
Exactly. You can take the car out, you know, younger. You can start your campaign to become a teen mom. Before you have your license now.
Technology
so.
Will fix the fertility problem.
Just as the founders intended, the driverless cars will get the teens pregnant.
Okay, so I guess I'll do my predictions then. So my political prediction is a two-part prediction. First is that Donald Trump and Joe Biden will be the Republican and Democratic presidential nominees. That's the first part of the prediction. And the second part of that prediction is that it's going to be awful. It's just going to be soul crushing.
What happened to where's your seven
in
now,
every
Suderman?
Possible way. my seven was a momentary, like a spark of hope that is gone already.
Okay.
20 minutes into the podcast. No, it's just going to be miserable. And like I said, soul crushing, even I think if you don't even believe in a soul. My cultural prediction, though, is something a little more near and dear to my heart, which is I think people are going to go back to the movies in a big and surprising way. Even without a lot of big tentpole superhero movies coming, there is only one MCU film coming. There's a couple of like Spider-Verse movies coming out from Sony, maybe. But really, this is going to be a year not quite totally without superhero movies, but without the glut of superhero movies that we have seen in the past couple of years. And we have already seen some of the signs of how that market is changing with films like Barbie and Oppenheimer overperforming this summer. But even over the holiday season, where the Aquaman sequel kind of flopped. Yet movies like Godzilla Minus One and The Boy and the Heron and even the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory movie all did pretty good business relative to their budgets. And in the process, we are going to find out what movies will look like in the next world once comic books no longer dominate and maybe once Joe Biden and Donald Trump are out of our political picture. So the next thing I want to talk about is what we learned and what we can apply. So in theory, as time passes, you get older and you also get smarter. You learn lessons. And so for this one, I want everyone to talk about something we learned last year that could be put to use in the coming year. Now, this can be for you personally, or for the nation, or for some relevant subgroup, some organized class of people. What is one thing that was learned in the last year that could or should be applied to make 2024 better? How are we going to achieve progress? Catherine, let's start with you.
AI is the thing that I thought about in 2023 that's going to be relevant in 2024. Is it progress? Is it chaos? Is it all of the above? I'm not 100% sure yet. I do think this is the last presidential election cycle that isn't significantly impacted by AI.
This is to AI what 2008 was to social media?
Or
2004, maybe?
I was going to say, like, you know, you remember, we're old enough to remember, some of us on this podcast.
This is an entire podcast of elder millennials, by the way.
Gosh, speak for yourself. I'm Gen X, and that's how it is. We are old enough to remember the election that the internet started to matter. Remember when the internet was like a thing that people on CNN were like, this candidate is better at the internet, and that might help him win. Like, that was a thing that people said. And I think that people are mostly just screwing around with AI right now at the consumer level. And, you know, typically political campaigns lag the private sector and also just kind of like private uses generally. But this is the last time that we will have maybe all human candidates for president. I'm not sure. Depends on how quickly things accelerate, like paging Ray Kurzweil to answer that question, I guess. But, you know, we're going to see a little bit of that. But what I learned is that in 2023, a lot of people tried to get a handle on this issue and failed. Like, there's just a lot of people trying to get a framework, trying to plug it into something they already believe, trying to make it align with their pre-existing values. I think in 2024, that's going to continue. I hope that that's going to continue, because if people do manage to somehow align this to just like red, blue America or whatever, it's going to make the whole conversation stupider and less productive. I think 2024, we should learn that like AI doesn't fit in the boxes and just try to go from there.
Wait, AI is libertarian?
AI is libertarian, Peter. Maybe.
It's going to disrupt the two-party system.
It's the end of human freedom. I don't know. One of the two.
We'll find out.
No one else knows either.
Do you have any set ideas as like any predictions as how AI might affect political discourse? Because I'm just imagining like that moment in that debate keeps popping into my head when Christie called Vivek Ramaswamy like ChatGPT. And it's like, is that how it's going to manifest? Is we're going to see candidates like this who they just feel like their teleprompter is just filled with LLM like generated text.
Yes.
And yeah.
Because I think we already understand that lots of political speech is filler text. It's just, you know, the words you have to say between, you know, evoking a couple of key feelings or ideas. And so for sure, all of that text will be written by chatbots of various kinds quite soon.
I think it's going to enter into our politics in a more concrete way than that, though some of that for
sure. But I mean,
we're going to have debates about regulating AI generally, debates about regulating AI drugs and how fast we need to test, you know, do the testing there. But also, I hope, frankly, that we are going to have some debates about using AI to make government work better. Because the thing that AI is really good at is pattern recognition. And government does a lot of stuff that can be subject to pattern analysis. And AI might show us places where there are perhaps some inefficiencies.
Yeah. No, for sure to all of that. But I also think Zach is right that an undervalued thing or like an interesting thing that's going to happen is like our politicians are going to start to sound more alike. Like Donald Trump already sounds like a tweet that was generated by an AI that was told to generate a tweet in the style of Donald Trump. And I think that there's just going to be more and more of that until we have a kind of like convergence of political rhetoric that is very different than
like
how politicians
all
sound
headlines
now.
In 2016 were the same, and you'll never guess what Donald Trump just said, what crazy thing.
Right. That was actually a very, very early example of basically what is now accelerating. But I think for the most part, this election cycle will only see glimmers of it. And it's not till the next one that blows up.
All right. So what thing did we learn in 2023 that we could use to make 2024 better? Liz Nolan Brown, let's go to you.
So one just minor life hack I want to say is, you guys know they make little tiny colanders that go over the tops of cans, so you can just drain the can without having to like pour stuff out. And it's just the most amazing product. Yay, capitalism, that exists. I think everyone should know that. It's my best discovery of 2023.
Wait.
I did say that it could be a personal life lesson.
I don't understand.
I'm going to do a real one too, but I just needed to tell people that.
Is it like a little shower cap?
Yeah. Yeah, and it just like fits on like a can of beans or something, so you can just pour it upside down without having to hold it on.
Wow.
It's brilliant. Everyone
Better
should look for these.
Bean
they sell them on Amazon.
Opening technology.
Okay.
I would expect no less from our Ohio correspondent.
I'm basically like advertising Tupperware here. But I think one thing is that, you know, a lot of times we have old laws on the books and we think like, whatever, those haven't been enforced for decades, or maybe they haven't been enforced for a century. So like, no big deal. And that can reverse. And we've seen that with the Comstock law, which is the terrible law against mailing, you know, things that can be mailing paraphernalia about birth control or, you know, tools of abortion or other sort of things that can be used for immoral purposes. And, you know, passed in the Victorian era. And it was just sort of like terrible, but then people stopped using it. And it was just like, okay, whatever, we'll just leave that on the books. It's there, but it doesn't matter because nobody's going to enforce it. And now we're seeing a lot of like, it play into a lot of these court decisions over abortion bans, with a lot of conservative groups being like, well, you know, we should, you know, do this because the Comstock law is still there. And we've seen that for a lesser degree with like a lot of these really old abortion bans that have been on the laws for like 100 or more years that were just like dormant. And now after Dobbs, they came back. But I think the Comstock law is the big one, because it felt like such a thing that was just like a historical relic that nobody was going to revive. And now everybody's trying to revive it. So I think the lesson is that, you know, we should actually repeal bad old laws, even if they're, you know, people think like, oh, that's just a funny old timey thing. No one will want to use it again, because you never know what's going to happen, and they could.
Repeal bad laws, always a good lesson to learn. Zach, what do you have?
One thing I think we learned in 2023 was that Javier Milei in Argentina taught us that an unapologetic, charismatic libertarian can win the presidency under certain extreme conditions, such as triple digit inflation and a collapsing economy. And what I hope we can learn from this is, let's not get to that point before taking some of these key libertarian insights seriously. Like, let's not let the debt spiral out of control. We're already at, you know, $34 trillion. I saw Peter sending around this morning that even the New York Times suddenly is admitting that the debt matters again. Don't create insane protectionist trade barriers that mess up supply chains, or let the money printer go burr endlessly to fund political projects for special interest groups. Let's take a hard look at federal agencies, even ones that have been around for a long time, and like seriously ask, is there some other way to do this? And then we just need someone on the national stage with the charisma and talent to actually persuade people and win an election. Easy peasy. That's my lesson.
Wait, if the secret to electing libertarians is for everything to go really badly and for us to have a currency crisis and way too much debt.
It's not.
And yeah. See, this is a little split here between what you're saying about Milei and what Catherine always tells us, which is the way to make things better is not to have them get worse.
And Zach is offering
saying,
the smartest.
Yeah, I'm saying we need to step in with Milei. Like, we need to somehow show people that we don't want to get to the point of Argentina, because then it's going to be real. The fix is going to look real ugly. We want to apply these lessons before we get to 100% inflation.
Zach is doing the Christmas Carol version of this. Like, he doesn't he doesn't want to get to the dark future. He wants like the ghosts to come and visit us.
Malay
and...
is the ghost of Christmas future. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
The very boring version of this is all those old CBO reports that were just like, you know, these problems are easier to fix if you try to fix them earlier. And then right. nobody tried
That's
to do that.
Some New Year's resolution energy right, right. there.
So for my lesson for the coming year, based on the past year, I don't know if anyone else saw the remarks by former NIH director Francis Collins that were making the rounds over the last couple of weeks, but they were actually from this summer. But he basically said public health experts got it wrong in some notable ways during the pandemic by focusing exclusively on their narrow area of expertise and prioritizing things that they thought would save even one life over everything else. They put in place and recommended some bad policies because they were thinking far too narrowly about their own expertise. And so I think that is, you know, that is a lesson that people have started to learn in 2023. I think we saw Francis Collins saying stuff like this. We saw in the Gavin Newsom versus Ron DeSantis debate, Gavin Newsom trying to escape the label of lockdowner by saying that DeSantis was actually the one who had locked down hardest, right? And that's basically good. But what I want is for people to take that and apply it to 2024, not just in terms of lockdowns, not just in terms of mandates, not just in terms of, well, if there's another pandemic, but in a more general way. Because the type of error that was made here was a general kind of category error of thinking that experts can remake society overnight on a whim based on their expertise. And it doesn't work, and it creates really bad problems. And so next time all the experts and all the people in charge have a grand plan to fix everything right now by reorganizing the whole world, let's maybe not do that. Okay, so we're going to do a lightning round here to end our 2024 section. I want to talk about your goals and resolutions for 2024, either for yourself or, and this is this is for Catherine, because I know you don't make resolutions for yourself, you can also make a resolution for someone else. So please feel free to make resolutions to make resolutions for Nick Gillespie and Matt Welch specifically, but also, you know, Joe Biden, Donald Trump, Elizabeth Warren, Josh Hawley. Catherine.
I'll make a cheater's resolution for this podcast as a whole, which is that we're going to resolve to make this into a video podcast in 2024. We are practicing right now as we speak with our cameras, and soon you will be able to see rather than only hear every time I roll my eyes during this podcast.
Love a resolution that is actually an advertisement. Zach, what is your resolution?
Well, since we're entering an election year, the discourse is likely to get really warped and polluted by partisan nonsense, people just saying whatever they think they need to say to boost their candidate or tear down the other side. So I want to resolve to double down on not doing that and just trying to engage in the best version engage with the best version of opposing arguments, you know, not strawmanning, not insulting, and very importantly, not getting bogged down in arguments with people who are engaged in that kind of bad faith stuff. So this is all smuggling my own advertisement. It's something Liz Wolf and I are both trying to do on our
wow.
new weekly podcast, Just Asking Questions, which I hope a lot of the roundtable listeners will give a try. And just something I want to do online and in person as much as possible.
That's a good resolution for other people, is to listen to your podcast or show. Liz?
mine is also an ad. Sorry.
Oh my God. Right?
You know, my other ones are boring. Like, read more books. Like, okay. So I'm going to do an ad. Sorry. I did the Reason Roundup for like 5 years, the Reason's morning newsletter, and then recently handed it off to Liz Wolf.
Thank you for your
service. And I'm going to have Yeah, and I'm going to have my own new newsletter launching soon, which is going to be specifically focused on like sex and tech policy and speech issues. And so I'm really excited to sort of like really hunker down on more beat specific writing and just be doing like much more blogging in the sex policy and tech policy realm, and covering that stuff in a much more like intensive way than I have gotten to in previous years.
Hey, if our listeners have any ideas for what to name that, that would be really helpful. We're really struggling.
Not the dongle, because everyone wants to call it the dongle.
I want to call it the dongle, but
I do not.
All right, we're going to resolve to not call it the dongle. I am once again going to call an audible here, since you guys have covered my resolution ideas. And you know what my resolution is? 10 pull-ups. That's it. 10 pull-ups. Yep. So with that, we are going to get on to our sponsor. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You've all heard the saying, new year, new you. But maybe you should be thinking the opposite of that, or at least something a little bit more manageable. Around New Year's, we tend to become obsessed with how to change ourselves instead of just expanding on what we're already doing right. Maybe you're getting to the gym 3 times a week, but you really want to work on your pull-ups. Maybe you're a journalist who's finally getting your M-dashes right, and now you want to get your state abbreviations correct, too. Therapy helps you find your strengths so you can ditch the extreme resolutions and make changes that really stick. Therapy can help you learn positive coping skills, how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who have experienced major trauma or have serious emotional problems. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, and it's designed to be convenient, flexible, suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. Switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit BetterHelp.com/roundtable today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable. All right, so we're going to call this next segment Service Journalism, because it is about state-funded services. This is our reader question. Jesse L. writes, "Hello, Knights of the Roundtable. You talk frequently about the different options for government services, such as high-tax, high-service states like California, New York, and New Jersey, versus low-tax, low-service states like Florida and Texas. I am a New Jersey resident, and I have spent the last week in Florida." Good for you, by the way. Maybe this is just anecdotal, but Florida blows New Jersey out of the water in terms of services. For instance, when my Bergen County roads look like they're actually in Bakhmut, the Collier County roads are freshly paved, the playgrounds are superior, they have sunshades, they are equal or greater. There's better trash pickup or recycling than in my boroughitis town. So what exactly is Florida doing so much better to provide the kind of daily services I actually want to consume? Zach, you are our resident Florida man. Let's go to you. What's Florida doing better than New Jersey?
Well, first, let me just completely validate what Jesse is saying. I immediately noticed when I moved from LA to Florida, oh, wow, the roads don't have a pothole every 5 miles, and tree roots aren't pushing up and cracking the sidewalks everywhere, and the parks are pretty nice, and so are the schools. And if I can just take some of those examples one by one, we covered some of this in the Florida issue, but the roads, especially the highways, I think work pretty well because Florida's government has put into practice many of the ideas that Bob Poole, Reason Foundation's transportation policy director, has advocated for a long time, like variable price toll lanes. So like, you know, the price goes up and down when depending on how much traffic there is. So that not only makes the traffic flow better, but it actually funds the road improvements and expansions as they're needed. And the people actually using the roads are the ones paying for that. Florida also about a decade ago rejected a high-speed rail proposal that got really close, and that money has been able to go towards, I think, more useful transportation infrastructure now. And Florida, ironically, now is beating California to a semi-high-speed rail with a privately funded project called Brightline, which has seen pretty good ridership so far and is recently expanded. And even if it does fail as it expands, at least the taxpayers don't have to be on the hook the way California's botched high-speed rail project has. And then with schools, you know, we've got a lot of school choice, including just giving parents money if they want to send their kids to a private school. And that's created a nice marketplace of schools here and also relieved some of the overcrowding that has a pressure that's happened as a lot of young families have moved here. And overall, I think it has to do with a couple things. One is, you know, in California, there's a very entrenched political class that has a grip on governance there. And I imagine that I don't know much about New Jersey politics, but I imagine it's a similar situation here. For a long time, Florida's been more politically competitive. That's changed somewhat in the DeSantis era, and we'll see what effects that has down the road. But, you know, having to actually, you know, be a little more responsive to the voters, I think helps. And then also, I do think it's like just all the retirees that have always flocked to Florida forever. They want to have nice amenities. They want things well maintained. And that's always been a big part of Florida's appeal. And Florida's state laws have helped enable that by devolving a lot of the maintenance infrastructure down to the local levels, which sometimes even involves creating these hyper-local special districts or even just letting a private developer take care of stuff that the public sector usually would take care of. So just a very different mindset. Things aren't perfect, obviously, but it is true that many things just seem to work better on the like municipal services level.
Catherine?
Yeah, I mean, I think Zach is exactly right. And if you want more on this, you can, of course, also go listen to Nick Gillespie's great interview with Jeb Bush. Jeb, yes. Who has some thoughts about Florida on this question. But I also think there's just the, you know, there's the question of what services do people see and what services do they value? And I think that in many states, the concept of what a service even is has gotten completely unmoored from the user experience, right? So, you know, I think like Denver would say that it is providing like a very high level of service when it comes to zoning and like building approval. Like they're really doing the most to protect the quality of neighborhoods and the green space in the city or whatever. Places that pay to attract stadiums, not that that's a super specific example that's super relevant to where I live right now or anything, but people that pay to attract stadiums are going to say like, well, this is a service that we're providing and look, people can see it and they like it. So, you know, I think roads are a classic. There's a reason that when people object to libertarians, general worldview, they say, but what about the roads? Because roads are important to people, especially in this country.
I think they say very specifically,
ma roads. Yes. Especially in this country where people are very car oriented. But I think in some ways what we're really talking about here is just states that are more in touch with what their users, what their citizens actually want, versus what they think they should want or should have. All these states are providing what they perceive to be services, but some of them are, at least to my mind, not services nearly so much as they are shackles.
So the thing that I would add related to what both Catherine and Zach said here is that when it comes to government programs, the expensive stuff is high-touch social services. Now, that includes education, because education is a very sort of person power intensive, right? It's especially if you want small classrooms, but also health and welfare type programs. And that is what Florida does an awful lot less of. So let's do one final lightning round segment here on another Florida man, but his experience in different states. Since the last time we taped the roundtable, a few things have happened in the news. And one of those is that courts in Colorado and Maine banned Donald Trump from their 2024 presidential ballots. The reason is because the 14th Amendment, which says that certain public offices cannot be held by individuals who participated in an insurrection or something insurrection-like, and the courts in both of those states ruled that that includes Donald Trump and the presidency. So we're going to call this final segment, Democracy is Off the Ballot. Catherine, is taking Trump off the ballot good for democracy?
Nope. I don't think so. I do not think that he would be a good second term president, but I don't think that that is the question at issue here. And in fact, there are at least two other questions at issue. One is, what even is an insurrection, and did Trump participate in one? And two is, even if he did, does Section 3 apply to him? I think this it is very, very likely that the Supreme Court will end up resolving this on the last token, if I had to guess, that they will sort of say the presidential oath doesn't really qualify under Section 3 or something like that, thus getting to what I actually think is the correct outcome in terms of avoiding further insurrections or other political unrest, which is that it will go back to the place it should have been all along, which is to the people to decide whether Donald Trump should be president again. We just can't have a large number of random government officials deciding what is or isn't insurrection. Like the Civil War, like that one's clear. And, you know, I think that just in general in our founding.
To you anyway.
Just in general in our founding documents, in our kind of key formational texts for the nation, like you have to remember that these were written under specific circumstances. So we also just have stuff in there that was like kind of specifically to like keep Alexander Hamilton from being president, or like just to keep like some of these assholes that tried to, you know, form a Confederacy out of office. It doesn't, you know, those rules oughtn't be there, oughtn't be used in the most expansive definition possible to allow a cadre of powerful people to make decisions in lieu of the general public, particularly with respect to elections, which are built for the general public to decide.
Yeah, I was fairly convinced by an op-ed in the New York Times by Kurt Lash that walked through the wording of the specific clause in the 14th Amendment and showed how ambiguous it is, and then argued that Trump shouldn't be removed from ballots based on a dicey reading of an ambiguous provision. It would be one thing if the Constitution were very extremely clear on this, but it's not. And in the absence of clarity, Trump should be allowed on the ballot. Let's go to our final segment here. What have you been consuming? What did you read, watch, otherwise engage with over the holiday break? Zach, let's start with you.
I watched Todd Haynes' latest movie, May December, which stars Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman and explores a problematic age gap relationship. And I don't mean that in the way that it's become used with like a 25-year-old and a 40-year-old. I mean, a woman who had an affair with a seventh grader and then had his kid and then married him. And it's apparently loosely based on a real scandal.
Very loosely, but yes.
Yeah, very loosely based. And there's some incredible performances from those two actresses and directing, and obviously really disturbing material. But what I liked about it is this extra layer where you're seeing it all through the eyes of an outsider. Natalie Portman, who playing an actress who's studying to play Julianne Moore's character in a TV movie. And she's just trying to figure out, like, first, what the hell is actually going on with this relationship and how not to portray it in a really cheesy, salacious way. And then you're thinking, watching it, I'm like, wait, is me watching this actually salacious and, you know, a bit of head games going on there? But it's so well done that it then inspired me to go back to one of Todd Haynes' earlier films, which is called Safe. And despite being made in 1995 and set in 1987, it feels somehow even more relevant to today than May December, because it's about a woman who becomes sick with some unknown condition and then is convinced that it's the modern world around her that's poisoning her, and then kind of retreats into this unplugged oasis / cult. And then there's a lot of masking.
This was before there was even Wi-Fi
in
the air.
What's that?
This was before there was even Wi-Fi in the air.
Exactly. Yeah, the Wi-Fi, the EMF attacks are not even on the agenda at this point. But, you know, there's just a lot of fear of chemicals and modern medicine and, you know, something for everyone. So I started a Todd Haynes bender, and maybe you should too.
I loved May December. It is such a delightfully complicated movie psychologically, and it does It does a great job with difficult subject matter, but even more than that is it does a great job of showing how even extremely psychologically astute people don't know themselves and hide things from themselves. And it's a movie about that, the gap between your perception of yourself and your actual self. And it just gets at the difficulty of even knowing of knowing anyone, including yourself, I think better than almost anything else I've seen in many years. Liz, what is your cultural consumption?
I've been listening to this album that I got. My husband is Thai American, so I got him this album. It's called Tie Dye, like Thai question mark Dye D A I, which I guess means yes in Thai. The heavier side of the Luk Thung underground. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, but it's a compilation of Thai funk and rock and surf tunes from the 60s. And it's originally released in 2011. It's based on this like Bangkok dance night that they've been holding there, or that they used to hold there at least, that these two DJs found old records, digging this stuff up and unearthing it and playing it at this dance night. And then they compiled this album based on it. It's just a really interesting sound. They're, you know, singing in Thai, and there's this sort of Thai, instrumentation going on, but it's over these quintessentially American or British like surf rock and psych rock beats, and it's a lot of fun, and it's really interesting. I've previously been into Thai go-go and Iranian go-go music, and this is sounds a lot like that kind. I mean, very different, but it's hits that same sort of spot, which just makes you think like, yay, cultural appropriation is beautiful. And yeah, it's fun. You can listen to it for free on Bandcamp, and they also sell it there.
So DC is kind of the home of go-go music, and you sometimes walk just across town, and there are big people with big speakers out just playing go-go on the streets. But also famously, DC was a great punk rock town, and one of DC's most famous punk rock bands is Fugazi, which basically blended sort of early 1980s New York style punk rock with go-go beats. So now I'm wondering, who is the Thai Fugazi?
They're on this album, probably.
I guess I'm going to have to listen.
Yeah, probably. I cannot pronounce their name, but they are on this album.
All right. I'm looking forward to this now. Catherine, what did you consume over break?
I was just sitting here laughing because that is like such a Liz Nolan Brown recommendation. Like the deepest of cuts, the hipsterest of takes. But then I realized,
but also personal,
but
and
also
about
personal
her family.
And full of awesome. So, but then I realized that I am sitting here inside my glass house and should not throw stones, because my recommendation is also a real KMW cliche. I read a book called Index, A History of the. And it is a whole book about indexes. It's a whole book about indexes, and it's great. This book is going to be my whole personality for like about a month, so get ready to be sick of me. It's by Dennis Duncan, and it was recommended to me by Dominic Pino of National Review, who mentioned it in passing while we were literally in a bookstore. And I was like, I can't even wait to find out if this book is in this bookstore. I just bought it on my phone from Amazon right away because I was so excited about it. Among other things, this book explores the fear that overtook people upon the invention of the index, that people would stop reading properly if they had the option to just look stuff up in the index. So this is one of the earliest tech panics. In fact, there's an insult that people used against each other. Index raker is the word for someone who is just going to check the index for the relevant passages and not read the book as its author intended. You cannot have indexes until you have codexes. That is, you can't have indexes until you have sort of bound books with page numbers. Making an index to a scroll is a deeply unsatisfying activity. This, of course, overlaps interestingly with just generally the kind of popularization of books, the wider availability of books. Just when you thought you knew about all of the tech panics, I am here to bring you Index Panic.
So I like that you discovered this book while in a bookstore with another writer, because the index, of course, gave rise to the possibility of the thing that we know as the Washington Reed.
Yes.
Which is where you go into a bookstore and don't read the book at all. You just look for your own name in the back of the book.
I did not look for my own name in this book. I did look for Adam Smith in this book because, as I have said on this podcast before, I think Adam Smith is one of the great index makers of history. He doesn't even get a mention, but this book is so good, I will forgive it. The index does have in itself a running joke in which it drags you through the index using words that are synonyms for wild goose chase from the beginning of the index to the end with cross references.
That's so annoying.
It's so good. It's so good. One last tidbit, again, because I'm not going to shut up about this book, is that it explores the idea that it is not actually intuitive to use the alphabet to organize things. Like, that was an intellectual leap. Like, you have this list of letters, but it's just a list of letters. You could organize things all kinds of ways. And the intellectual leap of using alphabetical order as a general way to impose order on the world is something that I had never once in my life thought about. And it's a pretty cool thing that humans did.
I have come to appreciate a good index in a cocktail book, because a good cocktail book has multiple indexes. They organize by drink, by ingredient or base spirit, and then also by things like, you know, name or place of origin or bar or that sort of thing, right? A more conventional index of proper nouns that have been named. But from a cocktail book, you want a lot more than that. You want sort of, I'm mixing stuff with rum today. Let me just see all of the recipes that are related to rum.
You sound like a depraved index raker, Suderman.
Well, sometimes when you're reading, you want to read the whole book first, but sometimes you haven't read the book in a couple of years and you need to remember
what
which
is
page.
The digital equivalent of that insult. Is it like the control F or something like that?
So this book is objectively pro control F, which is interesting. Okay. Like, they basically say, like, there's this beautiful index at the end, but it says if you're reading this in a digital edition, just use the search function.
Yeah.
So
there should be a digital version of this insult for people who don't watch television shows but just read the Wikipedia summary. Speaking of which, I watched season 3 of Slow Horses on Apple TV. It is just great. It features a fat, drunken, long-haired, mean-spirited, and utterly miserable Gary Oldman leading a team of spy rejects in the British intelligence service. In every season, what you see is that the biggest danger actually comes from the bureaucrats at the top. Because the bureaucrats running the show are really just politicians. And politicians, in this show's worldview, are just self-absorbed status monsters who only care about their own power. Also, the show is really surprisingly funny and really smartly plotted, and Gary Oldman is just so delightfully mean, and I am so happy with this show. That is it for today, folks. If you like our work, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. Matt Welch will be back in the driver's seat next week. Happy New Year.